Today on Maine Calling, what's next in the race for the presidency? Joe Biden's exit from the race for the White House raises many questions for the Democratic Party, including how it will choose its successor. For Vice President Kamala Harris, who is emerging as a likely candidate, and for the campaign of Republican Donald Trump. What will it mean for the American people, particularly undecided voters in battleground states, who could decide the outcome of the race? I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll get reaction from Gene Cummings, former deputy D.C. bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and USM political science professor Ron Schmidt. We'll explore how this shakeup may play out heading into the Democratic National Convention and this fall's election. And as always, we want to hear from you. How do you think Biden's exit will change the race for the presidency? Maine Calling is coming up.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. It's been less than 24 hours since President Biden announced that he will not seek a second term. But a lot is happening, and the response has kicked into high gear. Today we'll talk about the seismic shift in the presidential race and what to look for in the days and weeks ahead. Joining me, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science and the department head at the University of Southern Maine. And Gene Cummings, former Washington deputy bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. And we invite you, as always, to join the conversation. What do you think of Biden's decision? How do you think the presidential race will change? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. So many questions on this day two of this major development, but let me get a general impression from each of you now that you've had a day or so to take it in and watch some of the fallout. Gene, we'll start with you.
It was a surprising decision. His camp had stood firm. Not completely unexpected, though, given his performance over the last few weeks. I felt like after the debate, they needed to put him in controlled settings so he could illustrate that that night was a one-off. And they did do that. But then he didn't perform well in those subsequent appearances. A couple of rallies, he did okay. But the interviews with the media were not that great. And so he wasn't rebounding at all. The polls were starting to reflect the softening of support. They didn't initially, but that grew with time. So, and I, for one, am curious about the fact that he's got COVID. We don't know his condition. They say it's mild symptoms, but it does, you know, a mild symptom from COVID is being tired. And it could be that he just decided, while he can be president for the next 4 months, he really didn't have another 4 years in him.
Yeah, and maybe some of this will come out with time, exactly how this played out. Which we'll talk about a little bit, as much as we know about. Ron, if you were teaching a class today on this development, what would the lecture focus on?
I've been dealing with that, with putting out that fire for years now. I was surprised when the announcement first came, but then I guess my main focus since then, in a classroom sort of way, has been on both the institution of the presidency, but also the institution of the party. I feel like Biden's real great strength has always been that he knows the Democratic Party very well. He knows its players. He knows the rules and the relationships. And what he did in 2020 and 2019 that was impressive was pulling together a big cross-section of the party behind him to support him. So my first question yesterday was, what is this going to mean for that? And are we going to see that kind of cross-section of the party begin to coalesce quickly behind Harris? And so far, it has been. She's had support now from some unions and labor activists, from the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, from the New Democrat Coalition, which is a fairly conservative Democratic group, and from a number of leading progressives in the House. So at this point, she seems poised to build on that strength of the president. But it's still early, and it's remarkable to see this level of, I guess I'd say, risk taking in an election with these kind of stakes.
Yeah, I was going to say, so were you surprised that the support for Harris emerged so quickly right out of the blocks?
Well, I was hoping it would, but I just in terms of the story of the party and the strength of the party, but I wasn't necessarily expecting it to. It's coalescing pretty quickly. Some of the really big names in the party who were calling out for the president to not run again have not endorsed Harris. So we'll see what happens there. You know, I've heard some people who say they want to make sure that people know the rank and file support this before the big names weigh in. I've heard others wondering if maybe there's some hesitation still on their part. We'll have to find out.
Yeah. Gene, what can we expect from Biden when he does talk to the nation later, I guess later this week or whenever that is?
Yeah, he said he wanted to do it this week and later in the week. I expect a call for unity, an examination of his own record, because legacy is the question here. And that's what he is preserving. And rightly so. He has a very good legacy that he owns and he built and worked for. So he'll probably make the case against a return of Trump and make the case for Kamala Harris. And he might offer some insights into why he made the call. I suspect he will do that, only because it's bewildering to many people after, you know, he had been so steadfast. So that's, you know, I just expect him to deliver remarks that would be his own eulogy.
Mm-hmm. This is not the first time in history that we've seen a president who declined the nomination for another term, but and you know, we cite Lyndon Johnson often in these discussions, but this is different, right, in that it's Ron so late in the game and seem to be really against the wishes of the candidate in this case for up until the very last moment. So it's kind of, that's an unusual moment in history.
It is. It's, I mean, LBJ, by the time he left, I think was pretty bitter and feeling like he was being not supported and pushed out in a sense. But it didn't play out the way that this did. And you're right exactly about the timing. I think what has to be sort of haunting a lot of Democrats' minds is that election, the 1968, which was also a Chicago convention, which descended famously into complete chaos. And interestingly, it was a reaction to that convention that led to the reform of the reliance on primaries and this attempt to really get rank and file voters involved in selecting a candidate and standing behind them. So this is an interesting contrast, I guess, to that moment. But like I was just saying, how quickly people are seeming to coalesce behind Harris suggests that we're not looking at another 1968 Chicago.
But there has been this insistence that from Harris herself saying, you know, this is not a coronation. I will earn I will earn the nomination and I will win the nomination. But does she really is she really going to have to clear some hurdles here, or is this just kind of an exercise in quote unquote earning the nomination, Jean?
I think it's more the latter, but it's not nothing. I mean, she got on the phone immediately, and her people say she made 100 phone calls yesterday. That's a way of earning. That's a way of working. She didn't just sit back and say, okay, it's mine now. She is making appeals within the party to build, as Ron said, the coalition that they need to win in November. And so she's courting people and explaining to them, you know, why they ought to line up behind her. And that's really important. If she didn't reach out, if she wasn't doing that, then I think, you know, there'd be talk of some kind of challenger, and there just isn't any, which I'm not sure any of us would have predicted.
Yeah. Joining us now is my colleague, Kevin Miller, a political reporter for Maine Public. Hey, Kevin. Thank you for joining. Thanks for joining today. I was just going to ask you a couple quick things here. We've had response to this news, some response from the Maine congressional delegation. Can you tell us what we've heard and what they've said?
Yeah, so far we've heard from all four members of the delegation. Representative Shelley Pingree, who's a Democrat in the 1st District, she said that basically praised President Biden for his performance and really credited him for leading us through the pandemic and historic infrastructures, climate, or historic investments in climate and infrastructure. But what's interesting is none of our delegation members came out and endorsed anybody at this point. So Shelley Pingree said that she's putting the American people first and, quote, passing the torch to the next generation of leaders. But she doesn't say who that leader is going to be. Representative Jared Golden, who's a Democrat representing Maine's much more conservative 2nd District, he said that it was the right decision for the good of the country. But again, Representative Golden didn't endorse. And Golden created quite a stir a few weeks ago when he wrote an op-ed predicting that Trump would win the race in November, and that he was okay with that, even though he said he wouldn't vote for Trump. But he also said that he wasn't ready to endorse Biden at that time because he wasn't sure about his health and his ability to continue to lead for another 4 years. And as of this morning, he hasn't endorsed the vice president either. Mm. Senator Angus King is a independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats. Again, he didn't endorse anybody in particular, but he said that the American people are in need of a new leader who can take on those abroad and trying to destroy democracy and tackle these issues at home. But again, he did praise President Biden. And then lastly, Senator Susan Collins, who is our only Republican member, she just sent out a very brief statement saying that she appreciated his service to the country, that this was a difficult decision to make.
And you mentioned, the Northern Maine is the more conservative. Trump did very well there in 2016 and 2020, earning an electoral vote. But it's held by Democrat Jared Golden, who is up for re-election. How has all of this, or how might all of this affect that election in the 2nd District?
It's a good question. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Certainly, the Republicans have been trying to tie Jared Golden to President Biden because he's perceived as being not as popular in the 2nd District. And it's seemed like a safe assumption that it was likely Trump was likely to win the 2nd District again based on the fact that he won in 2016 and in 2020. So the Republicans have really been trying to tie Jared Golden to President Biden. Jared Golden has been very careful about the way he's worded things, and he has not endorsed, like I said, the president at this point. And I think this might complicate things because that in some ways takes away one part of the Republican argument against Congressman Golden. Now, of course, they're still going to try to tie him to the next nominee, whether that's Vice President Harris or anyone else. And they're certainly going to try to link him to aspects of the Biden administration that they say are unpopular that he supported. But he is a moderate Democrat, and he's done well, obviously, the past three elections, winning in a district that has leaned Republican.
Yeah, well, we'll see, and we'll see what all the advertising sounds like and all that. Kevin Miller, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kevin Miller, Maine Public's State House correspondent. So, first of all, any thoughts on what Kevin just said? Yeah, Ron?
You talked before about issues with teaching. Representative Golden is, for me, a great example of the idea that all politics are local. He's done a very good job of figuring out how to tell his message in his particular district. And I'd expect him to adjust to a new Democratic candidate and to sort of maintain that kind of profile. I don't think that necessarily tells us a lot about other parts of the Democratic Party in general, but it certainly suggests that he knows how to control his message in a way to reach out to his coalition.
So we don't really know what's going to happen here between now and August 7th, the deadline for the Democrats to choose a nominee. There's been talk about various types of processes in the convention. But, Gene, what's your thought here on how the Democrats, what does it look like, how they're going to maybe decide their next the candidate?
Well, we're really, you know, in uncharted waters. So they had tentatively planned to do an early roll call of delegates to kind of lock up the nomination for Biden. And they may do something similar for Harris, or at least as a way of trying to create an impression that the delegates have a voice in what happens next. There have been three state delegations that have already come out and endorsed her. They may look to do something like that. There's been, like you said, talk of town hall meetings or just some way to make this look more Democratic than it is at the moment. So they may try something like that, and certainly want to kind of lock things down before they get to Chicago so they don't have a mess on their hands. They still could have a mess, though. I mean, in some ways, very different, but I'm reminded of the 2016 Republican convention that Jared Kushner himself described as a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. And I recall Cruz standing up there giving a speech and refusing to endorse Donald Trump. I was kind of surprised he got out alive after that. It was really messy in 2016 for the Republicans. It still could be messy this cycle for the Democrats. But I do think there's a sense, if you listen to what Pelosi said, that she wanted to have an open process. Few others have brought that up. I do think there's a corner that really wants to make this look like they let the delegates have a voice in the process of choosing the next nominee.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue the conversation when we come back. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about President Biden's decision to leave the race for the White House and his endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris to be at the top of the Democratic ticket. My guests are Ron Schmidt, Department Head and Professor of Political Science at USM, and former Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau Deputy Chief Gene Cummings. Join the conversation. Tell us your reaction to the change in the presidential race. You can email us at talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram. The number to call is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We do have an email from Vinny in Brownfield who writes, as everyone knows now, a Biden dropped out and is endorsing Kamala Harris. That means that independents, responsible women Republicans and Republicans of color can now vote for a candidate. Trump's statements in the past toward women and minorities will come back to haunt and defeat him. Poetic justice. Thank you, Biden, and all to all the influential Democrats that pressured him. I think the sun just came out. Ron, is there is a sense in many corners that this news has sort of re-energized a Democratic Party that kind of had been in a state of malaise over the debate performance. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, you know, President Biden had a lot of support in 2020 from Black Democrats, from Black women Democrats in particular. And there was concern about whether or not this push to move him off the ballot was going to be seen as an act of disrespect toward those very important constituencies. And assuming that the things continue to move smoothly for Harris, I think the Dems will dodge that issue. And this could be reassuring to women and to minorities who are not Republicans. It's also going to make for a very striking contrast, given what the convention seemed to say about the role of women and a women's future under the Trump administration, and certainly in the face of all of the mass deportations now signs, to have the former president running against a candidate who is the daughter of immigrants herself.
And Gene, if money talks in terms of engagement and excitement, Harris's or the Democrats have raised something like $50 or $60 million since the announcement yesterday. Is that a sign? Is that part of the equation here of that something's happening?
Yes, that's important in several ways. We had not seen donors flex their muscle the way that they started to flex their muscle this time, where they were threatening to withhold like $90 million unless Biden bowed out. And that, there was not a reflection on Biden's record or as a person. It was the age and acuity question. So it frees up all of those funds. There was a donor on CNN this morning that said he will be giving even more because he sees new life for the ticket. The other constituency that we should look at are young people. They were really depressed about the fact that they had to choose between two old white guys, and now they don't. And if the young people now that are part of the Democratic constituency re-engage with enthusiasm and excitement, that really gives the party an added advantage going into November, because a lot of young voters were really checking out. And they don't have big sway in election, but they do bring energy. They can play important roles in the ground game and knocking on doors and as volunteers. And in that respect, they could be more important than just their own vote. So it'll be interesting to see if this enlivens that particular constituency.
And just let's expand on that a little bit. And Ron, feel free to jump in here. What would you say are the pros and the cons of Kamala Harris here as the nominee in terms of who she would help to deliver, maybe that Biden had lost, as you just mentioned, the younger vote, versus where she might not do so well?
I mean, one of the big pros for Harris is that she's already been part of a winning national ticket. I mean, I think that to me was one of the strengths of Biden's message, was that when he kept saying that he was the only person, Republican or Democrat, to have defeated Trump in an election. And Harris was part of that, and she has that experience, and she's shown that she can do that, and she's shown that she can mobilize very important parts of the base. And then there is this intangible that Gene refers to, that the impression on the part of Democrat and Democratic-leaning voting publics that the party has a new life, that it's got a new moment or a new moment of possibilities that can provide a certain level of energy. The electorate is so locked into partisan voting patterns these days that mobilizing the base is incredibly important. Swing voters still matter just because the races are so close that a few percentage points can make all the difference. But an enormous amount of the American public has already chosen sides. So the question of who has the most energy for the campaign is life or death. And Harris might right now seems to be delivering that. Whether she can sustain that, we'll see.
Right. Let's again, the number to join the conversation. We would like to hear from you. The number 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Camille. Hi, Camille. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am calling to ask, first of all, I'm happy that Biden dropped out. I think he should have done it at the beginning. But I'm wondering why your guests aren't talking about Biden's policy on Israel and that being the reason why he's lost progressives and the young vote.
Okay, well, now's a good time to get into that. We're trying to fit in a lot, Camille, this hour, but that's a good point, and we will I will ask the panel that. Obviously, the debate over Israel and its Iran and its relation to the United States and what's happening in Gaza has all been extremely difficult for the president. How does this change affect, I guess, maybe the party's standing with progressives?
I mean, it creates the potential for some movement because President Biden has a long history with Israel. And although he was trying to bring some pressure to bear on the prime minister, Netanyahu, there wasn't a lot of signs that was getting a lot of traction. We don't really have a record of Harris on Israel or on the issues relative to the Gaza war. But that does mean that there's a relatively open slate there for her to write. As far as progressives go, Biden actually has shown a lot of support among leading progressives in the last few weeks, more actually, frankly, than I expected, given this issue. So hopefully Harris, from her part, will be able to hold on to that support and build on it.
Yeah, Jean?
Yes, I agree with Ron. This is not an issue that we've heard Harris speak extensively to, and now she's going to have to. You know, her portfolio didn't include this. So we'll see how nuanced her message is, because Biden was pretty hard line, and, you know, because he'd been dealing with the Israel issue for decades, and he had a well-established position that he was not going to abandon. And as Ron said, he was trying to put pressure on Netanyahu to change tactics. And I mean, I always felt like, you know, that the October assault in Israel was their 9/11. And all of us in America probably have a sense that after our 9/11, nobody was going to tell us what to do either. And I kind of have felt all along that's where Israel is, although he's under tremendous pressure from within. So we'll see what her language is and how she frames the issue, because this is going to be fresh to everyone.
Yeah, Camille, I wanted to give you a chance to respond.
Okay. Well, I know that she takes a lot of money from APAC. So my sense is that the policy will not change, that we will continue to fund and arm and assist in a genocide. So I personally will not vote for anyone who supports what Israel is doing.
Okay. Camille, thank you so much and for raising the issue. Let's just, for the sake of our conversation here, assume that Harris wins the nomination. The conventional wisdom is in her next step, which would be to choose a running mate, would that it would be a white male governor from a battleground state, which kind of, I guess, narrows it down to a handful. Ron, what are the names that we're hearing?
Well,
I can tell you. I'll tell you. Sorry to put you on the spot there. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, North Carolina's Governor Roy Cooper, and Arizona Senator Mark Kelly have all endorsed her and are being discussed. So, and is that basically just it? They need to help deliver these states because that's the way to win.
It's not an excuse. But the fact that you caught me flat-footed is an indicator of the relative importance of vice presidents. Vice presidents tend to not matter very much until they matter enormously, as we can see in this larger circumstance. There's not a ton of evidence that a vice presidential choice is as key as we often think it is. You know, again, to talk about LBJ, we look back to JFK trying to make sure of the South moving forward, that kind of thing. There's not a lot of evidence that in modern times that kind of regional influence has been weighed. But like I said before, the closeness of the races means that something like this could matter enormously in a battleground state. That certainly seems to be a careful choice to make. Harris could surprise us in that regard, but I would expect that we're going to be concentrating on these people between now and the end of the Democratic convention.
Yeah, Gene, what's the thinking, I guess, in this case of picking the VP?
Yeah, there are a lot of things that she'll need to consider, assuming she locks this up. And what's also just important is this is the first big decision she's going to make. And so it'll be interesting to see how it's received and if it's viewed as her doing it well. Now, if you look at these, another one who's been floated is Kentucky Governor Beshear. If you look at them, the states matter. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Arizona, not so much Kentucky. Kentucky's a red state. Beshear is a very good politician. And as a Democrat, won because he's just damn good. He would, you know, expand maybe some reach in the South. Who knows? That's kind of a reach. The North Carolina Governor Cooper, on the other hand, is intriguing because North Carolina's been trending a little purple. Cooper is very popular. She also has a relationship with him. He was attorney general at the same time that she was in California. And it was through those ties that she also got to know Beau Biden, which brought her into Joe Biden's orbit. So he's intriguing. If you look at Senator Kelly, the thing to bear in mind there is they don't want to lose any seats in Congress, but he sits in a state with a governor, Democratic governor, who could appoint his replacement. So that might make him a little safe in terms of any worries that Schumer may have about losing, you know, someone from that chamber. And then, of course, the Pennsylvania Governor Shapiro, he's been a really reliable ally to President Biden. He's been a good spokesman for him. Pennsylvania's obviously an important state. But the truth is he can help from the governor's office as well. So ups and downs to all of them, and we'll see where she, you know, how she handles it. You know, is this typically a nominee meets with vice presidential potential candidates? Will we see that kind of parade go on, which could be embarrassing to some of them? Will she do it more privately? Will she, is this a way to get the convention delegates involved to have some kind of voice? We just don't know where we're going here, and there are many ways we can go, but it's going to be fascinating to watch.
And there's really no time. I mean, we assume that most of these, they're all obviously public figures, and they've been vetted for the level at which they're at. But vetting these candidates for a vice presidential level, doesn't that takes some time. That will obviously be rushed in this case.
Yes, it will be. And luckily, they have been vetted. But there's just one last thought, and then I'll let Ron jump in. They may look at it from the perspective of Trump's pick, J.D. Vance. And so that's where you might look at Kentucky Governor Beshear as a counterpoint to J.D. Vance.
I was actually going to say, I think Beshear himself was actually doing some of that narrative already to sort of position him as a real person of the Appalachia, as opposed to someone who basically plays one in Hollywood movies.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. Join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're discussing the latest developments in the race for the White House. Joining me, Gene Cummings, former Washington Bureau Deputy Chief at the Wall Street Journal, and USM Political Science Professor Ron Schmidt. Share your questions or comments. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. From Gail, who writes, any comment on this recent development through the eyes of the confirmed Republican ticket? In my view, Biden's timing was absolutely perfect. He stepped aside after the Republican convention, which leaves the Trump-Vance ticket with the oldest person ever to run for president now, and a VP pick that is a Christian nationalist who's on the record as advocating for a national abortion ban. So let's ask the question then about the timing, and does this give, well, you can comment on the timing, but, and does it give the Democrats a chance then now to turn the attention on their rivals on the GOP? Ron?
Yeah, the RNC convention was structured very much with the assumption that they were running a race against Joe Biden. And, you know, political parties are big bureaucratized organizations. We talk about them like they're ideological movements, but they're complex organisms. And moving something of that size is difficult. So they're going to have to make a dexterous pivot to shift over to not a different set of priorities in terms of policy, but a very different kind of candidate. And Harris has been the point person in the Biden administration on some of these battlefields, on issues about the border and immigration, on issues about women's rights and the right to privacy and the right to bodily autonomy, and in a much more focused way. That's going to create an issue for the Republicans' messaging. And it's also going to place a kind of demand on the sort of ways in which Donald Trump himself chooses to articulate his campaign. He's going to be running against an Asian African-American woman, and that's not a circumstance that's likely to bring out a more statesmanlike approach in his speeches, to say the least. And that puts him in a position that could cost him with swing voters, with white suburban women, with others who might be inclined to support him in lieu of a major gaffe.
Yeah. Gene, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Ron. I think she's going to take some really, he's going to deliver, and she's going to have to take some hard hits on immigration, which was already in Donald Trump's wheelhouse as a major issue. Flip the coin, she had become the spokesman for the Biden administration on the issue of abortion, an issue Trump has been scurrying from and evading, and he's going to find it harder to do that with her as the lead voice on that particular issue.
Trump joked, I guess it was on Truth Social, that the Republicans should be reimbursed for fraud for all the money they've spent running against Biden. But I guess the other side of that joke is that they, I guess what they're really going to try to do is what equate the two, that Harris basically is Biden.
That's likely. And getting back to the original question or thought, the timing of this being after the Republican convention, I doubt that that actually weighed much on Biden's thinking. I think Biden wanted to run, and for reasons we have yet to learn fully, decided, you know, he could do the next 4 months, but he really can't do another 4 years.
I agree.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Lee, who is calling from Sebago. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
My question is, if a candidate for president is looking at vice presidents to serve with them, why wouldn't they look for a vice president that maybe fills in the gaps they may have, maybe in foreign policy, or in her case, she's really good with abortion issues, but I guess I'm just wondering why they wouldn't be looking at something that fills in the extras, if that makes sense.
That definitely makes sense, Lee. Thanks for asking that question. I think, if I may, jumped in there.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I think that to some degree that has to do with perception. The Biden administration has pulled together a very professional foreign policy team, and I imagine a lot of those people will stay in place, assuming that that Harris wins. And so the perception of what strength she needs now has to do with her ability to hold on to some of those swing states that Biden won last time, but that Trump won before. And so the focus of the campaign is going to be more on that than it is on filling in policy gaps in her agenda.
Yeah. I do want to update, because we reported earlier that none of the main delegation had endorsed Harris. Shelley Pingree has since issued a statement endorsing Harris, saying that she is a proven leader who has faithfully served alongside Biden in one of the most successful terms our nation has ever seen. So we do have an endorsement from Shelley Pingree, and wanted to make that clear. Let's go to Jill in Brunswick. Hi, Jill. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Can
go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I came in late on the program, and I was hearing about the potential vice presidential candidate choices, and I just wanted to put out there that I thought Scott Kelly might be a really good choice with Vice President Harris as president. He is white. He is military. He is, I believe, also was a politician. He's retired now. And he's only 60 years old, which is sort of not too old, not too young. I thought he would be a good choice.
Scott Kelly, just to clarify, is the twin brother of Mark Kelly. Yeah, who was named
married to Gabby Gifford. So again, Scott had his. They were both astronauts. They have both been in the military. Yeah. But I thought Scott would be a good choice.
Yeah. Any thoughts from the panel?
One thing I'd note is that Mark Kelly has, as Ron pointed out, he's been vetted. And he's got experience, a lot of experience on the campaign trail. So, you know, the Kelly family is represented in him in the kind of name floating way that we're at the moment.
I did want to ask about we did touch on this with the Israel issue, but I want to talk about reaction from the world stage. I think the GOP characterized Biden as surrendering in a way that would signal to hostile foreign governments that the U.S. is weak and vulnerable in taking this step. I'm sure that our allies, everyone is watching closely what's happening here. Is there concern that the United States will be perceived as chaotic at the top level among our allies and our enemies?
Well, we're already perceived as chaotic at the top level by our allies and our enemies. And if you're thinking of allies, if you look at what just happened in France and to a lesser degree in the UK, this could signal the opposite, right? That a party has been able to adjust itself in mid-direction and to coalesce behind a new candidate and a new kind of election strategy could speak to a strength of our process rather than a weakness.
Jean?
I totally agree. I mean, anybody who's been watching American politics for the last decade or two knows it's can get pretty chaotic.
Right. So what is the next big piece of information, or I guess what is the next big story out of this whole change? Is it the process about how the next nominee is picked? Is it the VP choice? I'll let each of you give us a sense from your perspectives as to what is it that what's the next big thing we need to know or want to know.
I would say what I will be watching is that she's the choosing of a running mate is going to be the first big decision that she makes as a presumptive presidential nominee. And that will tell us a lot about her as a leader and how she evaluates, how many people she, you know, talks to. I mean, one of the things about a presidential campaign that people don't often notice or appreciate is how well you run your campaign is an indication of how well you can run the federal government. They're both big national operations. And if you can't run a good campaign, you're probably not going to be the best administrator in government as well. So this is a big decision for her, and how she measures, evaluates, you know, meets with people, whatever she does is going to tell us something important about how she might operate when choosing, say, a cabinet, and, you know, how she might operate in the White House.
Yeah, Rob.
I absolutely agree. And then also I'm curious in regard to the party, some of the major figures who were pushing at Biden, who have not endorsed Harris at this point, people like Hakeem Jeffries and Nancy Pelosi, they're not just solo actors. You know, they represent constituencies. And I'm interested in seeing what they and their backers want to see next.
And so if the VP choice is the next sort of test, will we also be looking for her performance at press conferences, possibly even if there's a debate? I don't know whether you think that's even a possibility or not between now and the fall. But what are the other tests, I guess, that we should be looking at?
Yeah, the convention is going to be an important venue. Her reaching out to the press and her press conferences are going to be important. The work that's not going to be public, but that will be reported on, her reaching out to various potential supporters, of course, is going to matter a lot. One of the reasons I think why there was this push to nominate Biden early before the convention is that some states required that ballots be printed before the DNC convention was going to happen. And so they were trying to finesse that. Just the question of how to deal with the state by state differences and the issues with state legislatures and state politicians, that's also going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time, but so much more to talk about. And as we anticipate what happens in the days and weeks ahead, Ron Schmidt and Jean Cummings, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ron Schmidt is the department head and professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine, and Jean Cummings, the former deputy chief of the Washington Bureau at the Wall Street Journal. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Main Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit the Main Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or listen to past programs. Tomorrow on the program, we'll listen back to our earlier show about the benefits of walking. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.